Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Attorney Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who explains why a coalition of human rights groups have filed war crimes charges against outgoing Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and other officials in the Bush administration. Jonathan Treat, a journalist living in Mexico, who discusses the ongoing conflict in the city of Oaxaca between federal troops and a coalition of students, teachers, and indigenous groups. And Kim Gandy, president of the National Organization for Women, who explains why her group is opposing President Bush's appointment of Dr. Eric Kerouac to oversee the Federal Office of Family Planning. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Christian Hospital in Sahiwal, Pakistan, is clean and orderly with few waiting lines for patients. Across town, the overcrowded municipal hospital has patients sitting in the hallways and out-of-date medical technology. According to the Boston Globe, the U.S. Agency for International Development, or AID, had given $53 million from 2001 to 2005 for Christian-based groups on healthcare, education, and disaster relief in Pakistan, Indonesia, and Afghanistan. Indonesians were upset that U.S. aid failed to award any prime contracts to Muslim groups after the 2004 tsunami in the world's most populous Islamic country. Critics questioned the nearly exclusive U.S. focus on Christian aid groups in the Muslim world. As Rob Boston of Americans for Separation of Church and State remarked, the last thing that we want to do is to create the impression in the Muslim world that the U.S. is funding groups that seek to convert Muslims to Christianity. Christian Hospital, run by the group World Witness, plays a film on Jesus in its lobby, and its brochure states terrorism can be ended through the teachings of Christ. Two Cuban exiles were sentenced on November 14th for stockpiling weapons for possible attacks against Cuba. 65-year-old Santiago Alvarez was sentenced to almost 4 years in jail, and his longtime friend and employee, Oswaldo Mitat, 64, was given slightly more than 3 years in prison. According to the South Florida Sun Sentinel, the courtroom was filled with supporters and relatives, some who were infuriated by the results of the case. Both Alvarez and Mitat are militant opponents of Fidel Castro's government, and both pleaded guilty in September to illegally storing a cache of weapons that included a grenade launcher, 6 machine guns, rounds of ammunition, and explosive materials. The weapons were hidden in a Broward County apartment complex owned by Alvarez. Under federal guidelines, both men's sentences should have been more severe. Santiago Alvarez is also a longtime friend of Luis Posada Carriles, another Cuban exile charged with masterminding the 1976 bombing of a Cuban airliner that killed all 73 people on board. Although both men were caught transporting weapons destined for terrorist attacks against Cuba, attorneys for both men call them freedom fighters. A rumored shakeup at the right-wing Washington Times, owned by the Unification Church, has exposed allegations of racism and sexism at the right-wing newspaper. According to The Nation magazine, Preston Moon, the youngest son of Unification Church founder Reverend Sungmyung Moon, is putting together a search committee to replace current Washington Times editor-in-chief Wesley Pruden and managing editor Francis Coombs. The younger Moon wants to moderate the paper's ultra-right-wing politics and favoritism towards openly racist groups and publications. Various sources inside the Washington Times say former editor Arnaud de Borchgrave is heading up the effort to replace top Washington Times editors. Founded in 1982, the Washington Times, which has a circulation of 100,000, is a key voice for conservatives. The paper has lost at least $1.7 billion. A shift in the news slant at the Washington Times could send shockwaves among conservative activists. In 2005, managing editor Coombs helped raise the profile of the anti-immigrant Minutemen, who ran citizen patrols on the border with Mexico. The American Civil Liberties Union has blasted the right-wing paper for inflating the number of Minutemen volunteers and ignoring the number of white separatists in their ranks. Editor Wesley Pruden has also given friendly interviews to overtly racist publications like Southern Partisan and made sure stories about Robert E. Lee's birthday appear to counter celebrations of the birthday of Martin Luther King, Jr. As Mark Potok of the Southern Poverty Law Center observed, the Washington Times is a terrible little newspaper that unfortunately has a vast disproportionate influence on the right wing of the Republican Party. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Denise Manzari. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.
On November 14th, a coalition of human rights groups filed war crimes charges in Germany against outgoing U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and other officials in the Bush administration, including Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, former CIA Director George Tenet, and Ricardo Sanchez, the former commander of American forces in Iraq. They are accused of either ordering, aiding, or failing to prevent war crimes. Led by the U.S.-based Center for Constitutional Rights, the groups are calling on the German federal prosecutor to investigate the responsibility of these high-ranking U.S. officials for authorizing war crimes, including torture and other human rights violations. The charges were filed on behalf of 12 alleged victims of torture, 11 of whom are Iraqi citizens, who were detained at the Abu Ghraib prison in Baghdad. The 12th man, who has been held at the U.S. military prison in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba since January 2006, is Mohammed al-Qahtani, a citizen of Saudi Arabia, whom Washington accuses of being a conspirator in the 9/11 terrorist attacks. The complaint was filed in Germany because that nation is a signatory to the International Criminal Court, and under German law, war crimes can be prosecuted irrespective of the nationality or location of the defendant or plaintiff. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who discusses why his group filed war crimes charges against Bush administration officials and the goals of this legal action.
For really 5 years now, the U.S. has been off the page in terms of having a torture program, both at Guantanamo and, as well known, in Iraq, and I think in other prisons and secret CIA detention facilities. The Center has always felt that this program goes up the chain of command. This isn't just a few bad apples, but is now, I think, publicly acknowledged that this was Donald Rumsfeld on one side authorized a lot of this. The president himself said on September 6th that he has to continue using these kind of techniques when he talked about secret CIA detention facilities. So our view, of course, that this is completely, flatly illegal. You can't torture people. You can't. It's a violation of basic law, it's a violation of Geneva Conventions, etc. A number of our clients have been tortured. One of them in particular, Mohammed al-Qahtani at Guantanamo, had a torture log that was actually essentially approved by Donald Rumsfeld. For 5 years, we've been trying to get accountability up the chain of command. Unfortunately, we have failed in the United States. All of the investigations that went forward, authorized by U.S. officials and the Congress and others, went down the chain of command and hit a few bad apples, the so-called Lindy Englands of the world, and they didn't go up the chain of command. And in recent times, they even gave themselves an amnesty for these crimes in the United States. In a recent act that was passed by Congress on October 17th, that was signed by the president, basically redefined war crimes so it would exclude everything from stress positions, hooding, stripping, use of dogs, sexual humiliation, hypothermia, taking temperatures down, all that sleep deprivation, all of that, exclude that as a war crime, even though those clearly violate Geneva. So we at the center say to ourselves, well, how are we going to get accountability here? And there's an importance for us in getting it, because when the United States, which is the major country and most important country in the world, starts doing this kind of stuff, it's not only a green light to do with our own people and our own soldiers, but it's a green light that every other country in the world can say, the U.S. is doing it, why us? So the question is, what do you do? How do you get criminal responsibility here? And one way is a concept called universal jurisdiction. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with it from the Pinochet case. And every country in the world has the right to bring criminal cases against people for war crimes, no matter where those war crimes were committed. So we decided to use Germany and to go there and use their national law, because the U.S. was hopeless and that Germany was a place that had a very good law on prosecuting this. And we went to Germany to try and get them to open an investigation of Donald Rumsfeld, Alberto Gonzalez, Ricardo Sanchez, the general, and then a number of the lawyers and other people involved in what I call the torture program.
Michael Ratner, explain to our listeners the smoking guns you have in terms of the hard copy memos signed off by Mr. Rumsfeld and others to authorize torture.
You don't need a lot of witnesses anymore to make a case that our country's highest officials violated the Geneva Conventions and committed war crimes. I mean, the earliest stuff surfaced, really, you know, not just the photos, but, you know, actual interrogation memos, techniques signed off by Donald Rumsfeld. From the lawyers, you have memos that were written, really, to overcome resistance within the CIA and other and some other institutions when the people said, well, we don't want to torture people. We don't want to do this. We're going to get violated by the war crime statute. So what are the lawyers, people like Bybee, who's now unfortunately a federal judge, or John Yoo, who's a professor out of Berkeley, what do they write? They redefine the word torture so it doesn't mean torture. They say Geneva Conventions doesn't apply, so you can't violate them because we're just going to say they don't apply. And they did these purposely so that these techniques that I've described would essentially not violate the law, in their opinion, and therefore give a sort of guarantee to people that they couldn't be prosecuted for war crimes. So you have all of those pieces of information. And then you have one of our clients, Mohammed El-Khatani. Mohammed El-Khatani is currently in Guantanamo. He's been in their custody for a number of years. And what leaked out on that was a Time magazine report that actually leaked the log of a two-month, what I would have to call torture interrogation of Mohammed El-Khatani, from stripping to hooding to using an IV to put water in his body so that when he was sitting in the chair, he was therefore forced to urinate on himself. To being put down naked on the floor and having women abuse him sexually, to, you know, sleep deprivation for 48 days in a row, and it makes the people who were involved guilty of war crimes.
What is your ultimate goal here? Because there are many naysayers who will tell you and tell the U.S. media, of course, that there's no chance Donald Rumsfeld's going to go to jail anytime soon. So are there any primary or secondary goals with this action?
Well, you know, in some ways, Scott, we've already met a primary goal. I remember reading about the resignation, and when I read the papers the next day on a Thursday, no one in any of the papers mentioned Rumsfeld's role as a key one of the conspirators in the torture program in the United States. And then we brought this case, and two things happened. One, it was surprising the interest in the case, indicating to me there's a change in the atmosphere, that the press was all over this case in Europe. People took it seriously in Europe. And the second thing is now, I think indelibly, Rumsfeld's name is now linked as part of the torture program in the United States. The next goal that we would like to see is we believe that there should be no safe haven for people involved in torture. What that means is a person who is involved in torture should not feel that they can just walk into any country in the world and be free and enjoy themselves, but that they may well be subject to subpoena, prosecution, etc. And that's already happened to some extent with Henry Kissinger. We want that to be the case for Donald Rumsfeld and other people who we believe were involved in the torture program in the United States.
That was Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Contact the center by calling area code 212-614-6464 or visit the center's website at www.ccr-ny.org. As the movement of teachers, students, workers, and indigenous groups marked 6 months of continuous protest in the Mexican city of Oaxaca, violence again erupted in the streets on November 20th, the day Mexicans celebrated the 96th anniversary of their nation's 1910 revolution. Running battles between the Federal Preventative Police firing tear gas and activists armed with sticks, slingshots, and fireworks resulted in dozens of injuries and arrests. Protests began in May when teachers went out on strike, demanding a pay increase and books for students. Oaxaca's governor, Ulises Ruiz, ordered police to attack the teachers and their supporters. That confrontation galvanized the teachers, sparked a civil society uprising, and the formation of the People's Popular Assembly of Oaxaca, or APO, which demanded the removal of Governor Ruiz, who many accuse of winning office by stealing the 2004 state election. At the end of October, Mexican President Vicente Fox sent 4,000 federal troops to Oaxaca to remove protesters from the colonial city's central plaza after more than a dozen people, including Brad Will, an independent U.S. journalist, had been killed by gunmen, whom protesters identify as undercover government agents. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Jonathan Treat, a journalist living in Oaxaca and coordinator of the Oaxaca Solidarity Network, who provides a brief history of the conflict and describes the current tense situation in the city.
The current situation started May 22nd when the teachers went on strike and were demanding not only raises but larger budgets for their schools that are very underfunded. And they set up a permanent presence in the Zocalo, in the city center, which is the heart of the city. And they were basically camped out there until June 14th when what many people consider the illegitimate governor, because he was elected basically in what is widely perceived to be fraudulent elections. He basically, in a pre-dawn raid, sent in Oaxaca State Police to break up the teacher strike. And they used helicopters and tear gas. It was a very violent police action. And that really worked against him in a very big way. It was a completely unsuccessful attempt to try to crush the popular teacher strike, because people in Oaxaca basically came out in the thousands saying that they did not want to live in a police state, that they didn't want to be in a situation where the police were breaking up nonviolent, peaceful, legal occupations of the Zocalo, for example, or legal actions. So basically what that did is the civil society joined together. It moved from being a teacher strike to being a much broader-based popular social movement. And since then, there's been a series of confrontations between the police and protesters, the People's Popular Assembly of Oaxaca, which is known as APO here. Soon after the desalojo, or the attempted throwing out of the teachers, by the way, retook the Zocalo. They organized and they retook the Zocalo by that evening. And what we started to see after that were what are widely believed to be plainclothes police have gone into the streets and selectively targeted people at the barricades, people who are APO supporters. Before October 27th, there were between 12 and 13 people who were killed, plainclothes policemen, drive-by shootings, that kind of thing. And one of the, I'm sure that many of your listeners are aware of the fact that a U.S. journalist, Brad Will, was killed on October 27th. And the very next day, President Fox decided to respond by sending in the Federal Preventative Police, which are the elite police, they're anti-riot police, basically. And since that time, here in Oaxaca, we've experienced basically the beginning, the establishment of a police state. Since the arrival of the Federal Police, the Federal Preventative Police, at least 103 people have been arbitrarily detained. 17 people now have been killed. 38 people at least are still being held in military detention centers. 19 people have been disappeared. There's at least 39 reported wounded among those five journalists, but observers say the figure is more in the hundreds, because those 39 are only people who have been documented, and many people are afraid to go if they've been wounded to public hospitals because of the fear of more repression.
So, Jonathan, where do you think this is headed? Where do you think the confrontation in Oaxaca is going in terms of the actions of the popular organizations and their coalition, APO, and the federal police? I've heard that in Mexico City, certain sectors of the federal government have called for Governor Ruiz to resign. Would that resolve the issues, do you think?
Well, it certainly would be a major victory for APO, and yes, it would defuse the incredible tension that we have right now, if Ulises was to leave. Ulises offered a six-point plan for reconciliation last week, and he was basically laughed at. He cannot reconcile because he is the biggest problem. However, that's not to say that if Ulises were to step down, that everything is going to be okay. Clearly, you have a political system that he's just a representative of that political system. The problem is that you have to look at what's happening in Oaxaca in a national context, because my personal opinion is that it's not convenient, it hasn't been convenient for the federal government to let this whole situation with Ulises Cerise continue. On the other hand, what they're very concerned about is the precedent that would be set if the people in the popular movement here in Oaxaca were to be successful and essentially throw out their governor. There's at least 10 other popular assemblies happening in other states throughout Mexico. And Felipe Calderón, the supposed president-elect now, is supposed to take office December 1st. That whole election, as you know, is hotly contested. Many people feel like that election, again, was a stolen election. Felipe Calderon doesn't have the kind of credibility that he'd like to enjoy. And at the same time, you see what's happening here in Oaxaca happening elsewhere in Mexico. And the Zapatista movement is coming out very strongly in support of APO and in support of this process of the creation of popular assemblies. So the stakes are exceedingly high for everyone involved.
That was Jonathan Treat, a journalist living in Oaxaca and coordinator of the Oaxaca Solidarity Network. Visit the network's website at www.oaxacasolidarity.org. In the 10 weeks between the November election and the swearing-in of the new Congress in January, President George Bush is pushing hard to get his favored legislation and key appointments approved by the outgoing GOP-controlled House and Senate. This comes even though many of the president's far-right views were repudiated at the ballot box on November 7th. In a move that demonstrates even more arrogance than usual, Bush has appointed a doctor who opposes birth control to be in charge of federal family planning funds. Because it's not a top-level position, Dr. Eric Kerouac, who would become Deputy Assistant Secretary for Population Affairs, does not require Senate approval of his appointment. But that isn't stopping groups opposed to his taking office from pressuring the administration to reverse itself. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Kim Gandy, president of NOW, the National Organization for Women. She describes Kerouac's extreme views and what steps NOW is taking to prevent his appointment.
Dr. Eric Kerouac, who has been appointed to basically to be in charge of the Department of Health and Human Services Family Planning Funding Program, giving out grants of this year $238 million in Title X family planning grants, is being opposed by NOW and by many women's organizations, because he has a long history of opposing women's right to use contraceptives. And we think that it, frankly, is rather weird and distressing to put an opponent of contraceptive use in charge of the nation's family planning grants. And we are concerned that because of his history of working with, in fact, he's been the medical director of a group of fake clinics, they call themselves crisis pregnancy centers, in the Boston area, because of his relationship with that organization, which we believe misleads women, that he will try to use the Title X family planning funds to enrich those kinds of organizations which actually discourage women from using contraception.
I did an in-depth report on the 40th anniversary of Griswold v. Connecticut, which was the U.S. Supreme Court decision that legalized birth control for married women only in 1965. A lot of people would hope that birth control could be the common ground for those on both sides of the abortion debate, because if reliable birth control were available to more women, women would have fewer abortions. But what I found was that every time I interviewed someone who was anti-abortion, they were also anti-birth control.
Well, that has been our experience over many years, although most of the anti-abortion crowd refused to admit that they were anti-birth control. For a very long time, they thought that that was something that would limit or perhaps even stop their efforts to halt abortion if they admitted that they also wanted to stop birth control, although I've been saying it for more than a decade that that really is their ultimate goal. And now we see that, in fact, it is their goal. They do not want women to have the option of using artificial birth control. And frankly, for those of us without much rhythm, the other option, the rhythm method, doesn't work very well. for those who didn't grow up in the days before Roe v. Wade, before Griswold v. Connecticut, when birth control became available in 1965, if you grew up earlier than that, you knew that the way that you could try to limit the number of births was by charting your cycle and trying to figure out as best you can from a variety of means whether or not you happen to be ovulating, and if you are near ovulation, simply avoiding having sex during that time. But some of us didn't have very regular cycles, and if you don't have a rhythmic cycle, the rhythm method didn't work.
Kim Gandy, after the election, where President Bush said the Republicans got a thumping, here he is reintroducing in this lame duck Congress before the Democrats take over many of his far-right appointments. Here he's appointed someone, Kerouac, for whom he doesn't even need congressional approval. This doesn't seem like a very conciliatory or bipartisan move. What do you make of it?
Well, it's very clear that George Bush, as is his habit, says one thing and does another. He says he wants to be bipartisan and then immediately proceeds to use this lame duck session to try to jam through everything that he can that is insulting to the desires of the voters who voted the Republicans out. Of course, now this Kerouac appointment, this guy who's anti-birth control, being put in charge of birth control programs, it has been literally our largest response in a two-day period of I think, any alert that we've done in the last couple of years. Tens of thousands of messages just instantly over our now.org website went to Mike Leavitt at Health and Human Services to say, revoke this appointment, find another job for this guy. He probably hasn't moved to Washington yet. Don't put him in charge of this. And we've also reached out to our congressional allies and asked them to deliver the same message to Mike Leavitt, who is the Secretary of Health and Human Services, saying this is really a bad move. You're going to need to work with this Congress. This Congress is in charge of your budget. This is really not a smart thing to do. And so we are doing our best to convey that message. And I believe that if enough people weigh in on this subject, this Kerouac will get sacked.
That was Kim Gandy, president of the National Organization for Women. For more information or to sign a petition against Kerouac, call area code 202-628-8669 or visit the group's website at www.now.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Tah. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Ruben Abreu, Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.